Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In today's show, we'll take a look at the history of one of the most popular forms of American music, rhythm and blues, as well as its ties to African Americans and race relations in the United States, with historians Eileen Dugan and Brian Ward. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. While all teachers experience some trepidation before meeting with new students, for Anne Sullivan, special education teacher from Massachusetts, her new assignment in Tuscumbria, Alabama, would prove to be particularly daunting and profoundly rewarding. During this week in 1887, Sullivan, at the request of Arthur Keller, met for the first time with a petulant, spoiled, disruptive child by the name of Helen Keller. Keller, who lost both her hearing and sight at 19 months, had become uncontrollably frustrated with her isolation from the world around her. Sullivan helped her end that isolation by teaching her finger spelling, the articulation of letters of words with her hands. It worked, but ironically, Sullivan lost her sight as well. Amazed by the success of Anne Sullivan's efforts, philanthropists like Andrew Carnegie and Alexander Graham Bell made donations to Keller's education fund, hoping that Sullivan's innovations would spread as effective means of treatment. Both women became famous, but by 1929, Sullivan developed a bitterness towards Keller, feeling that her contribution to Keller's success had been publicly neglected. Nevertheless, Sullivan did receive medals from the Roosevelt Memorial Foundation and the Education Institute of Scotland for her efforts. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, after 120 years of speculation, a faded note has confirmed long-held beliefs regarding the mayor's orders during the Chicago Fire of 1871. For over a century, rumor had it that Mayor Roswell Mason ordered that prisoners be released from city jails as a way to protect them from the ensuing flames. Sure enough, in a recent letter donated to the Chicago Historical Society, the mayor's frenetic words confirmed this suspicion. Release all prisoners from jail at once, keeping them in custody if possible. Given the widespread nature of the fires, which consumed over half the city's buildings, it's doubtful whether the custody of prisoners admonition was heeded. In what has developed into a serious image problem for the Pentagon, American officials recently commented on the status of a military investigation that hopes to uncover the truth about an alleged massacre of South Korean peasants by American soldiers at the beginning of the Korean War. So far, there are many conflicting memories of the event circulating, which took place near the hamlet called Nogunri in 1950. While South Korean survivors of the incident, as well as some U.S. soldiers, maintained that unprovoked shooting on the part of Army personnel resulted in a horrific scene of blood and death, other witnesses, mostly U.S. servicemen, maintained that there were disguised North Korean soldiers intermingled with the unarmed peasants. However, even those soldiers maintained that they were simply following orders and did not regard the group as posing an immediate threat to their mission. You're listening to Talking History.
Our day will come, and we'll have everything. We'll share the joy, falling in love can bring.
As with so many forms of American culture, the phenomenon of rhythm and blues should be seen in the historical context in which it evolved. And, again, as with so many of the most popular forms of American music, the historical context of rhythm and blues involves African Americans and the story of race relations in the United States. Here to help us explore the history of rhythm and blues is Talking History's Eileen Dugan and her guest, Brian Ward.
When asked to think of music reflective of the black experience in 20th century America, our thoughts tend to gravitate towards jazz. But what about other musical forms after World War II? Rhythm and blues, soul, funk, black pop, even, disco. What can the lives, careers, and lyrics of the Chords, Bo Diddley, Isaac Hayes, or Jimi Hendrix tell us about the civil rights and black power movements? With us today to discuss the social dimension of rhythm and blues is Dr. Brian Ward, lecturer in American history at the University of Newcastle-upon-Tyne in England. Dr. Ward is the author of Just My Soul Responding, Rhythm and Blues, Black Consciousness, and Race Relations. Welcome, Dr. Ward.
Thanks very much.
What are the origins of rhythm and blues?
Well, I guess, as the name implies, it's blues with a certain extra rhythmic dimension. But I guess musicologists would say it's what happens when some of the southern blues begin to migrate and begin to cross-fertilize with some of the swing modes of the 1930s. So if you like, it's a sort of a jumped-up blues sound that draws on southern blues, but is a more urbane and urban form.
And how do rhythm and blues speak, if you will, to the black experience in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, I think, you know, this is a time certainly in the American South of statutory segregation and, of course, a great deal of functional segregation and disadvantage in the North as well. I think rhythm and blues operates on a number of levels. On one level, we like to think of it as a dance music, a music of escape. But in a sense, that escape was highly politicized as well, because the dances were a place where, a little bit like church on a Sunday, where African-American communities came together and celebrated a sense of their own identities, a sense of their own heritage, and through the music were able to speak about, if you like, the things that were most important to them. So I think at one level, it's a sort of a communal cement along with many other cultural forms. At another level, though, I think it's also provides an entree for African-American artists and writers into the industry and sows the seeds that will later flourish in the 1960s for a degree of black participation in the, if you like, the business of American popular music as well as performers and entertainers.
Now, it's one thing for them to be able to make recordings, and it's another thing to get the exposure. What developments in radio and television began to give rhythm and blues increased airtime?
Well, I think, you know, the major development comes after the Second World War. Really what happens then with the growth of TV is you've got a lot of very anxious radio producers and advertisers and owners who are looking for niche markets because middle white America has become obsessed with TV, and they're really losing a great deal of their market share to this brand new media. So what they begin to do is they begin to look around for niche markets. And, you know, in 1947, the very first radio station in the American South, WDIA, begins programming for an African-American audience exclusively. Within 9 years, there are 22 stations in the South that are programming entirely for African-American audiences, and another 24 or 25 that are programming over 30 hours a week. And the reason they're doing that is not to enhance, you know, racial progress in the area. The reason they're doing it is because they've just discovered that 15 million African Americans are spending $12 billion a year, and they want a piece of that pie. The good benefit for African Americans, of course, is that they're getting more programming, they're getting more courteous programming. And the good thing for white Southerners and white eavesdroppers, if you like, for black radio, is that they're, you know, just by having a radio station, they're able to retune to black stations and get a good dose of this rhythm and blues music.
Now, were these black stations run by blacks, or were they run by others?
No. I mean, this is a sort of very telltale sign, is that the first black-owned radio station, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of WERD in Atlanta, Georgia, which goes on air in October 1949 and is the first black-owned station. By 1970-71, you still got barely a dozen black-owned stations. So these stations are white-owned. By and large, the managers of the station are white. The technical people are white. But the on-air personalities are black. And the vast majority of the music that's being played is, of course, by black artists.
And what effect is white ownership and white technicians going to have upon what is actually played and said on air?
Well, of course, to a certain extent, as long as there was the idea that only blacks were listening, African-American preachers and some NAACP representatives, some quite politicized statements could be made on air. Really, from the time that rock and roll emerges in the mid-1950s, and it becomes very clear that there's a white audience, particularly a young white audience for rhythm and blues music and white fans of these African-American disc jockeys in the South, from that point on, it becomes a little bit more difficult to talk about voter registration, to talk about attacks on the segregation system in the South. The censorship and the monitoring of what was being broadcast actually becomes, I think, tighter in the mid-1950s. And you get a good example of this when you know, one of the radio stations in Birmingham, Alabama, WEDR, actually has, you know, its antenna cut down by the Klan. They're not quite sure why this black-oriented radio station is somehow helping the cause of civil rights, but they're certainly sure that it is in some way. So the radio stations actually come in for quite a lot of attack.
And you mentioned that these stations did, over time, get a white audience. Who among the whites were listening to this? Were these the stereotypical rebels?
I think one of the problems of sort of identifying who these young vanguard white rhythm and blues fans were is there's a tendency to sort of homogenize them. They were a very diverse group. You certainly get a whole bunch of sort of college students from the universities of Virginia and the Carolinas who actually invited black artists onto campus at a time when their institutions were, you know, segregated. You have people, you know, performing for very enthusiastic white college audiences who would not have been allowed to enroll as students on these campuses. And there are many tales of people, of rhythm and blues artists, cutting their teeth on the Southern University circuit. So that's a sort of an educated, if you like, college-going constituency as well. By the same token, you have your archetypes like Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley, who somehow picked up on African-American rhythm and blues music, mostly over the airwaves, because it's very difficult to segregate the airwaves. You know, once you've actually got a radio receiver and you can turn the dial, you can pick up all sorts of diverse fare. So, you know, there's a various class groupings, if you like, in the American South among whites who actually pick up on rhythm and blues in the late 40s and through to the mid-50s.
And what do you think were the good and bad aspects of this attention from white audiences?
Well, I think it's a mixed blessing, let's put it that way. I think at some level it raised the possibilities of greater respect and understanding across the racial divide. But on the other hand, I think too many people who write about this subject tend to romanticize that potential. They tend to overemphasize that you know, shared love of the same music somehow was a portent of more progressive racial attitudes. And by the time you get into the, you know, the 1960s, the mere fact that the Ku Klux Klan can actually hire the soul great Solomon Burke for a concert and thoroughly enjoy his performance, but certainly didn't hang up their hoods when they went home, indicates that there's no necessary and absolute connection between white love of black music, white admiration of black genius, and more tolerant or progressive racial attitudes. So again, I think it's very important not to overgeneralize.
All right. Now, a strong recurrent theme in rhythm and blues, and later on in soul and funk, is sex.
Mm-hmm.
What you call the black macho element. Why was this so pronounced, and FCC standards aside, of course, why was this a problem?
It depends who it was a problem for, of course. I think, you know, plotting the degree of virulence of sexual hostilities in African-American music is actually a very, very interesting and revealing exercise. And although you mentioned the black macho side, one of the things I'm keen to stress in the book is that the women of rhythm and blues gave as good as they got in this sort of war. There's a dialogue going on between the sort of the macho heroes like the Wilson Pickets of the 1960s or Lovin' Dan, the 60-Minute Man of the 1950s in the Dominoes hit, and African-American women artists like Ruth Brown. And then, of course, in the soul era, you know, your Aretha Franklins and your Candy Stantons, there is a dialogue here. It's not entirely one way. But I think really what I tried to bring out in the book is that the intensity with which these sort of sexual hostilities are engaged in rhythm and blues music rises and falls in direct relationship to the progress or perceived progress of the civil rights struggle. To put it another way, at a time of exclusion before the movement has really gathered momentum in the 1950s, you get an awful lot of songs which depict domestic relationships, sexual relationships, as thoroughly predatory, as transitory, as full of spite and viciousness. That's not the whole of the story, and again, I'm keen to emphasize that, but it is a substantial element of rhythm and blues music. Then during the zenith of the civil rights movement, at a period of guarded but genuine optimism that ultimately African Americans will be able to overcome and secure an equitable place in American society, that strand of rhythm and blues disappears or becomes a very marginal strand in the rhythm and blues repertoire. And you get far more idealistic love songs. Our Day Will Come, Ruby and the Romantics. I use that as a chapter title because I think it embodies a moment of optimism and possibility. Then, as the movement fragments in the mid-1960s, amid the urban riots and the withdrawal of much white liberal support for the movement, you get another intensification of the macho and misogyny from the male side and its female equivalent. And I think that reflects the fact that some of these possibilities, some of these windows of opportunities have been slammed shut.
And how did whites react to hearing these songs that are so sexual in content?
Well, of course, you know, when you've got a standard airfare of Rosemary Clooney and Perry Como getting as down and dirty as they could, you know, these songs seem to be incredibly frank in the mid-1950s. You listen to them now and they seem extremely coy and somewhat naive and certainly more funny than actually spiteful or lewd would be a better way of putting it. But for white audiences perhaps not exposed to those sorts of lyrics and those sorts of themes quite so readily, this was a real eye-opener and undoubtedly accounted for some of the popularity of the rhythm and blues music of the mid-50s.
You tell a chilling story about Nat King Cole being attacked during a concert in 1956. What did this incident say about race relations in the South?
Well, I think it said one thing about the people who were orchestrating the campaign of resistance to the move to desegregate the South, which is namely that they couldn't tell a rock and roll singer from a jazz pianist and crooner. The whole nature of that attack on Cole, which took place in Birmingham, Alabama in April 1956, was really that it was an attack against rock and roll. Unfortunately, there was no rock and roll coming through the town at that particular moment, so poor old Nat King Cole took the brunt of this assault. I think really what's going on there is that there's a whole bunch of paranoias overlapping in the American South in the 1950s, especially after the Montgomery bus boycott is underway and the civil rights movement proper has really started in the wake of the Brown decision calling for the desegregation of Southern schools. Whites are very alarmed. They are lashing out in many ways at all sorts of what are perceived as assaults on the Southern way of life. And rock and roll is this great metaphor for all the evils they see associated with the civil rights movement and desegregation. You have a music that is produced by white and black artists, that is listened to by white and black artists, that seems to involve white kids and young black kids as well, and therefore conjures up all the sort of horrors of miscegenation and one thing or another. So I think, you know, rock and roll is a great metaphor for these segregationists, and certainly Asa Carter, the White Citizens Council leader who orchestrates the campaign against rock and roll in the South, talks about it in exactly those terms.
And how willing were R&B artists to take part in the civil rights movement in its early days?
They really kept a fairly low profile. I think when I started off this project, I was doing it from the movement side as much as the music side. I wanted to see what the movement participants, people who were involved with Martin Luther King, who were involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, actually what usage they made of rhythm and blues artists, what relationships they had with these people. And I think I secretly wanted to find out that Pamela Motown was funding the movement or that Sam Cooke was everywhere. In fact, the number of people who took a conspicuous part in the early civil rights movement from, say, 1955 through 65, 66 was minimal. And what I wanted to do in the book was not just establish that fact and lay blame, but to actually explain why so few artists felt able to play a public role in the movement, and also to celebrate those like Nina Simone in particular, who actually did play a very conspicuous and brave part in the movement in the early days.
And then eventually, of course, we see the rise of soul and funk, and how does that fit into the whole political movement, civil rights movement of the 1960s and beyond?
Well, I think what happens by the time you get the emergence of a fully-fledged soul sound in the mid-1960s, of course, soul is beginning to emerge from a fusion of gospel and rhythm and blues with the work of Ray Charles and Sam Cooke and, to a certain extent, Curtis Mayfield and James Brown in the late 50s. But it's fully-fledged nationalistic form. I don't think it really appears until the mid-1960s, by which time the movement has changed black and white minds, of course. And whereas in the early years, black rhythm and blues artists really sort of avoided direct engagement in the struggle for fear of losing their white audience. They were the first generation of African-American artists who really had a fair stab. Fair is wrong. It was still, there were still barriers, but had a good crack at a mainstream white audience. by 1965, they were in danger of losing their black audience if they didn't come out conspicuously in support of the movement. And of course, that took various levels, either singing songs like Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud at one level, but also they were far more to be found on marches, at fundraising events, at various publicity drives for black mayoral candidates and things like that. Much more conspicuous role in the movement from the mid to late 60s onwards.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Dr. Ward.
Thank you very much.
We have been talking with Dr. Brian Ward, author of Just My Soul Responding, Rhythm and Blues, Black Consciousness, and Race Relations.
Hard to forget that you've been cheated.
Continuing with our examination of the relationship between African-American music and black-white relations, we've invited John Cruz to offer us his thoughts on the discovery of black music by white elites in the 19th century and how that discovery reshaped 19th and 20th century American attitudes toward black music and culture. John Cruz is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He's also the author of Culture on the Margins, The Black Spiritual and the Rise of American Cultural Interpretation, published by Princeton University Press.
W.E.B. Du Bois once remarked that there is no true American music but the wild, sweet melodies of the Negro slave. Du Bois was right. The music of African Americans, rooted as it is in slave music, is, in the most profound sense, American music. We moderns look back at this legacy of slave music with an abiding appreciation. There are, however, complications behind this legacy. Consider that 200 years ago, slave owners, overseers, and accidental tourists heard slave music as wild, incoherent, and barbarous noise. However, by 1900, academicians were heralding black music as one of the wellsprings of American culture, and it became the object of benevolent appropriation. Romantics found in music cherished fragments of a pre-modern nobility. Highbrow composers like Dvorak reached down to uplift its themes to symphonic heights. Dozens of budding professional folklorists sought in at the secrets of pre-industrial culture that could be scientifically and taxonomically objectified. This story has a partially triumphant side. Over the centuries, black Americans garnered the hard-won recognition as makers of important cultural meanings. Black music had evolved from bad noise to good sound. But there is more to the story. For it was not black music in general, but the Negro spiritual that had been discovered, only music that appeared to have a religious dimension, passed through the benevolent doors of admission. All of the music remained noise. Frederick Douglass, the former slave, played a pivotal role in launching this new interpretive impulse. Douglass's autobiography, published in 1845, was the first writing by a black American in which whites were invited to discover with their own ears the inner world of slaves. Douglass unveiled a cultural interior of slaves that could be glimpsed through their songs of sorrow, which were testimonies to their struggle to endure and confront the heavy burden of slavery. After Douglass, black music was accessible to sympathetic cultural interpretation. The Civil War brought scores of discoverers. By 1870, the enterprise to collect spirituals was well underway. Yet as appropriation and interpretation churned on, this good black culture became increasingly separated from black social and political aspirations. There were ears to hear the idealized singing black subject, but there was also a profound deafness to the lessons of the slave narratives that had introduced them to both the black cultural interior and the nightmare of American society. Appreciation flourished over unfinished business. Blacks could be accepted culturally, but not politically, socially, and economically as equal members of American civil society. By the end of the 19th century, a peculiar interpretive framework had taken hold. It featured an idealized black and spiritualized cultural performer stripped of a political and civic identity. Our last century has attempted to rectify the blind spots, but histories have a way of hanging around. Consider how Michael Jordan and Ken Griffey Jr. appear as embodiments of disciplined Republican virtue and as promoters of corporate goods. Yet American society remains deaf to what many are now calling the deeply racialized prison industrial complex. We moderns still struggle with the old notions of performance that embrace and yet maintain people on the margins.
You've been listening to John Cruz, author of Culture on the Margins, The Black Spiritual and the Rise of American Cultural Interpretation. And this is Talking History.
Destination, heartbreak. I've been there.
one-way ticket to Teardrop. For this week's Site of the Week, we take you to the home of the blues, as well as the birthplace of rock and roll. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you're looking for the birthplace of rock and roll or the home of the blues, Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee is where you want to be. Essential to your visit there is the Center for Southern Folklore, located in the heart of the Beale Street Historic District. The center is the eyes and ears of the historic district and well known for its entertaining films and exhibits on Memphis music, as well as books, recordings, and tours. The center conducts tours of Beale Street and customized tours of the Delta region. There are daily concerts and performances, and on Labor Day weekend, the center produces its annual Memphis Music and Heritage Festival, a three-day event which celebrates and presents the music, food, folk arts, and crafts of the region. Contact the Center for Southern Folklore in Memphis for more details.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, from time to time we like to call to your attention news sources on history, in this case exhibits, that you can visit without even leaving home, perhaps in the comfort of your favorite armchair. This week we recommend to you an entire series of exhibits recently posted at the website of the National Museum of American History. They include The Star-Spangled Banner, which explores the history of Old Glory, Photographing History, featuring photographs by Fred Maroon of Richard Nixon, The Feather Trade, about the American conservation movement, A Visual Journey, Lisa Law's photos of America in the 1960s, Building a National Collection, 150 years of print collecting at the Smithsonian, Between a Rock and a Hard Place, a history of American sweatshops from 1820 to the present, Doubtless is Good, Thomas Jefferson's Dream for American Wine Fulfilled, and many more. To see these virtual exhibits, simply access the homepage of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we take a look at how young women come of age in America in our show, Delinquents and Debutantes. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Call me Mr. Beautiful, baby, that's my name. Call me Mr. Beautiful, that's how I got my fame. But people just don't understand what makes a man feel so beautiful. Ooh, they call me Mr. Beautiful, 'cause I know someone just like you. They call me Mr. Beautiful, this everybody knows. They call me Mr. Beautiful, 'cause every place I go.